Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland family. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Maiken Scott. For years, pediatrician Alexis Lieberman told new parents the same thing.
Don't start food until 6 months, and then you have to start with rice cereal, and then you can do fruits, and then you can do vegetables, and no eggs and no peanuts until one. And I've said that so many times, it comes out of my mouth very comfortably and happily.
I was given that advice by my pediatrician when I became a mom in 2008. Breastfeed exclusively for 6 months, give formula if you must, but no real food. No mashed up banana, no pureed carrots, nothing. I made sure I followed that advice to the T because it felt like it was crucial for my baby's health. It was supposed to prevent food allergies, which had seen a dramatic increase. Here's Jonathan Spergel. He heads the allergy program at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia.
The idea was to avoid, so we would avoid the food so you wouldn't get a food allergy early.
And it all made sense to Alexis Lieberman.
I mean, I used to have a whole explanation for why you shouldn't feed your baby food. Let's say you feed your baby some apple and their immune system, their gut lining isn't fully developed. And so
that advice was not at all based on research. And worse than that,
turns out we were dead wrong.
When serious research studies were done, it showed that early introduction of food was safe.
And in fact, it's possible that a lot of the peanut allergy epidemic that's going on is because of doctors telling people to delay peanuts, which is kind of a shame.
Now the marching orders are keep breastfeeding if possible, but start introducing real foods at about 4 months of age. And nothing is off limits. Here's Alexis talking to a new mom with a baby girl. The mom has food allergies in her family, and she's worried about this.
Let's say you made yourself African squash peanut stew. Yum, I want that. Puree some of that. This is a great way to give her the peanuts, for example. Put a dot on the lip, wait the next day, put a dot on the lip again, wait the next day, put a dot on the tongue. Keep your Benadryl on hand, just in case, okay? And that way, if she's going to have an allergic reaction, it'll be a fat lip and not a big allergic reaction. But delaying the foods does not prevent the food allergy. It increases the risk of the food allergy. Even though you look terrified in your face right now. You do, you look totally terrified.
Medical advice and treatments change all of the time. Sometimes it's a complete 180, and that can be really frustrating for patients and also for providers. But it's part of the scientific process. New research comes out, breakthroughs and discoveries happen, older approaches become obsolete. On today's episode, we take a look at changing medical treatments. How are those changes communicated? How do we keep up? Speaking of keeping up, here's a little postscript to what we just heard. So the current guidelines to start introducing foods to babies at around 4 months of age, they've been around for a long time now, more than a decade. But when I asked about this on parenting groups and on Facebook, it turns out people are still getting the wrong advice from their pediatricians. How is that possible? I asked Jonathan Spergel about that.
So it is frustrating because we're clearly not getting the message out to people. I hope over time we're getting better at getting the message. I think it was ingrained in society for a while that avoidance was good.
He says there's been a lot of effort to get this information out to all pediatricians through conferences and journal articles and to parents.
Things move slowly sometimes. I think we need to fine-tune our message out there.
But he says the heavy push for breastfeeding has confused the issue, or it makes parents reluctant to start introducing food at 4 months of age.
If I'm introducing food, my kid won't breastfeed so much. That's been found that's not really true. The kids still go to breastfeed, so they don't have to worry about that. I think there's some worry about that.
When there are new medical guidelines, new treatment protocols, or new surgery options, they usually take time to catch on. First, the information has to get out to providers and patients. And then there are lots of questions. Can we trust this yet? Or is it just too new? Let's say you need to have surgery. There's an older option that's not perfect, but at least it's been done for years and years. And then there's a newer procedure that seems to offer big advantages, but it's still uncharted in the long term. How do you weigh one against the other? Steph Yin followed one family as they tried to make that decision.
13-year-old Bailey Pence has been doing gymnastics and cheerleading for most of her life. She lives in Parker, Pennsylvania, a town outside Pittsburgh that bills itself as the smallest city in the United States. Her family has hours of footage of Bailey cheerleading and doing gymnastics. In video after video, Bailey's trying to master this one move. It's clearly her favorite, the back handspring. 2 or 3 years ago, she could land several in a row.
Good job, Bailey.
But not anymore.
Because my back got so bad, and it, like, hurts if I try to do it.
Over the last few years, gymnastics has gotten harder and harder for Bailey. This fall, she had to drop out entirely.
It's sad, and it's kind of, like, stressful. I feel like you're trying to do it, but you can't.
What's keeping Bailey from her gymnastics is scoliosis. She has what's called adolescent idiopathic scoliosis. It's the most common spinal disorder in teens. As many as 5% have it. Her mom, Beth, tells me Bailey's pediatrician detected her scoliosis when she was 9.
They just did that simple test, you know, that we used to do, was bend over and touch your toes. And when she did, they noticed that she had a curve.
Bailey's curve was concerning. Her doctors monitored it over the next several years. Bailey tried physical therapy and 2 different braces, but she was in constant pain.
I have back pain a lot.
She had headaches or migraines almost every day from tension in her neck and head. When you're looking at a spine from the back, it should be a straight line, 0 degrees. But Bailey's backbone takes a sharp turn, 50 degrees to the left. On x-rays, you see what looks like a backward C in the middle of her spine. And the curve kept getting worse. Last October, Bailey visited her doctor.
He said, we're kind of at the end of our bracing journey. Like, surgery was the next route.
Each year, some 30,000 scoliosis surgeries are performed on teens in the U.S. When doctors recommend surgery, it usually means that left alone, the scoliosis will continue to progress. Eventually, it'll start to crowd other organs, mess with lung function and breathing. Bailey's doctor told her she should get what's called a spinal fusion. For a long time, that was the only surgery for scoliosis. Patrick Cahill, a spine surgeon at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, explains spinal fusion. First, surgeons cut open the back.
A fairly long incision where the muscles are dissected off of the bones of the vertebrae.
Then they install screws on the sides of each vertebra, or each bone along the affected part of the spine. Next, they feed a metal rod, about the width of a pencil, through the screws. This looks something like braces for the spine.
And then those are used to pull the curved spine over to a straight alignment.
Then comes the fusion part. The surgeons roughen up and break off bits of the vertebrae.
To sort of trick the body into thinking that it has a broken bone.
In response, the body starts to grow new bone.
Then bone graft is laid on the back of the vertebrae so that as they grow new bone, they sort of coalesce and grow into one long bone between all of the vertebrae.
It's like a biological welding of the spine. Spinal fusion has been around since the early 1900s, and it's had many iterations over the years. The farther back you go, the more mixed reactions you get from patients. Eliana Bergman is 33 years old, originally from Florida, but currently living in Jordan. When she was 11, an orthopedic doctor told her her scoliosis was getting life-threatening.
If you don't have surgery, you're probably going to die. Your rib cage is going to collapse and your lungs are going to be smushed. You're not going to be able to breathe.
Eliana had a couple spinal fusions, the first in 1999.
I'm fused basically from the top to the bottom.
She knows spinal fusion potentially saved her life, but it also came with muscle spasms and nerve issues. It didn't get rid of her daily pain. It just changed it. and the surgeries permanently restricted her motion.
I'm just like a big piece of metal or a wood that's just very stiff. If I'm bending over forward to, for example, tie my shoes, I literally look like a piece of wood just bending over. Like, I don't have a curve, a natural curve to just be able to bend over. It doesn't happen.
But in the 2 decades since Eliana's surgeries, spinal fusion has had major improvements. The metal rods implanted along the spine have gotten more flexible. Recovery times and long-term side effects are way down. These days, spinal fusion is the gold standard in scoliosis surgery. Here's Patrick Cahill again from the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia.
For a child today that gets a spinal fusion, instead of being a life-altering event, I describe it more as a bump in the road.
Still, back in Parker, Pennsylvania, Beth Pence was not happy to hear Bailey's doctor prescribe a spinal fusion.
I actually know a couple people that have had rods, and they tell me they live in pain every day. They also don't have mobility like they'd like. So we left that appointment feeling very, very defeated. I know I went out in the waiting room, I kind of cried and cried and just didn't know where to go from there.
Beth posted an update on her Facebook, and that's when a mom from a scoliosis support group called Curvy Girls contacted her.
She said, "I think you need to consider VBT.
VBT is vertebral body tethering. It's a new surgery that swaps out rods for rope. It was only approved by the FDA in August 2019. Before that, it was still considered experimental.
It was just like the news I needed to hear at that point. It gave me hope.
VBT is meant for patients who are still growing. A tether that looks like a clothesline holds the long part of the spine in place so that the short part, the part that curves in, can catch up as it grows. Think of it like taking a tomato plant that's bending over to one side and tying it so it straightens out over time. Just 2 weeks after that phone call where Beth learned about VBT, Bailey's family made a 6-plus-hour drive to Philadelphia.
We did our first procedure here in 2011.
That's Amir Simdani, chief of surgery at Shriners Hospitals for Children in Philadelphia. Beth wanted to meet with him because he's a pioneer in VBT. But after talking with Amir, things actually felt less clear.
He said she'd be very successful for fusion or for VBT, and he listed all the pros and cons of both.
Under VBT pros,
the main benefit is that the rope is flexible. There's no doubt that compared to rods, VBT patients move dramatically better.
That's a big plus for gymnast cheerleader Bailey. VBT patients are typically back to sports within weeks, compared to months for fusion patients. Tethering is also less invasive. Rather than making a huge cut down the back that leaves a big scar, VBT requires just 6 small incisions. And while a spine can't be unfused, tethering is reversible. The rope can be released or adjusted. As for cons,
the biggest drawback is the predictability is not as high as with a fusion, meaning if you want to reliably get your spine straight, then fusion's the better option. With VBT, because it relies on growth remaining in a child, the end result can be hard to predict.
Meaning, with VBT, there's a fairly good chance that the patient will need a follow-up surgery. So far, that's happened to about 20% of Amir's patients. Sometimes the spine overcorrects and starts curving the other way. Sometimes the rope breaks. There's always a chance that the tether won't do the job, and the patient will need to get a fusion anyway. Though doctors are optimistic, no one really knows how VBT will play out over the long term. The first VBT patients only got their tethers 10 years ago. For some spinal fusion patients, problems don't crop up until 20 or 30 years after surgery. Here's Baron Lawner, a surgeon and professor of orthopedic surgery at Mount Sinai in New York.
What will be interesting is to see how the VBT procedure changes the natural history of long-term outcomes. My hope is that VBT patients may do well and do better longer term, but that remains to be seen.
Amir, Bailey's doctor, also does a fair deal of fielding spinal fusion horror stories from the past.
Our first several patients were patients who needed spinal fusion, needed rods put in their back, but whose mom or aunt had previously had a spinal fusion and was very unhappy for whatever reason. And they had set in their minds that no matter what, they were not going to let their niece or their daughter have fusion surgery. There is this shifting baseline, and we spend a considerable amount of time telling them, listen, spinal fusion has evolved. It's a good operation.
All that was a lot of information for Bailey's family. Here's Beth again.
He was very honest about everything, and it just made it hard. I knew what I wanted, but then when he listed all the cons, I guess, I had to take some time to think about it.
She even tried the whole, if this was your daughter, what would you do spiel?
And no one would answer that question for me.
Her husband and Bailey's dad, Josh, actually left that first appointment in favor of spinal fusion.
When he heard the doctor say one and done, he was like, oh, we should do fusion. We'll never have to worry again.
Plus, Josh says it just seems smart to go with the option with a longer history.
Just do with the track record only being 10 years versus 55 years.
Good morning. Good morning. Hey, everybody. How are we doing?
Fast forward a few months, it's the morning of Bailey's surgery. The sun is just starting to rise in the pre-anesthesia care unit when Amir Sindani comes in.
Okay, feeling a little nervous? That's normal, okay? If you weren't nervous, then I'd be worried, all right? But you're gonna do great. You're only number, I think, 502 now, so. So I think
you might have guessed by that number, 502, which surgery Bailey ended up going with. The Pences chose VBT. After that first consultation, Beth talked to other families she found online, heard about people's experiences with fusion and VBT. Those conversations pushed her in the direction of VBT. But in the end, the most important factor of all, Bailey wanted VBT.
I knew I didn't want the rods because I couldn't, like, do gymnastics and stuff.
This has to be her decision. It's her life, ultimately. We are parents. We need to make sure she's safe. But, you know, this is her life to live.
When I visit Bailey 3 days after her VBT surgery, she had just gotten her chest tube out. She checks her lung function on a spirometer. One of her lungs had to be deflated for the surgery. Mom tells me Bailey's been a champ. She started walking laps around the hospital floor the day after surgery. And Beth says she's already noticed some changes.
Her shoulders were very uneven prior to surgery, and I feel they're leveling out to look pretty equal.
Bailey feels a little different, too.
It's like, I feel it made me taller. I don't know if it actually did. It just feels like it.
Even Dad, who is so on the fence, feels the family made the right decision.
Well, it's only the first week, but I'm very pleased with it. She seems to be recovering nicely.
Postoperatively, she's been a trooper.
I also got to catch up with Amir, the surgeon. I asked him, what's next for scoliosis patients? Already, I know there's another scoliosis surgery just around the corner called ApiFix. It involves a rod with a ratcheting device that can move as the spine corrects over time, and it might be available to patients as an experimental treatment by the end of this year. And Amir says the possibilities aren't limited to new surgeries. As scientists better understand the causes of scoliosis, solutions in gene therapy or gene editing may be on the horizon. Doctors are already using gene therapy to treat other spinal disorders.
Perhaps rather than even needing an incision, you just have an injection into your discs that are abnormal. And then my dream is one day that we can just take a pill and you're able to, treat your scoliosis. Obviously, that would put a lot of surgeons out of business, but that's okay.
So VBT is not the final frontier?
If VBT was the final frontier, I would feel I had failed in my career. I mean, we have to keep improving.
As for whether Bailey will do a back handspring again?
I would say I'm hopeful, but we'll have to wait and see.
That story was reported by Steph Yin. This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about changing medical treatments, how we learn about them, and how we navigate them. In recent decades, there's been a big push to bring more scientific rigor to mental health treatments. Anything related to mental health existed outside of the rest of medicine for a long time, so there weren't as many studies, not the same kind of research or clinical trials. If you have depression, anxiety, or OCD, you can try lots of different things that somebody will call therapeutic, but will it actually help you? What do we know about how that treatment works or why it works? Jad Slaman looked into this, and he started out by trying one pretty new therapy method at a hotel.
I'm in a small hotel conference room in Philadelphia with three women, all mental health professionals.
Turn your chair like towards the wall.
I'm about to try something called accelerated resolution therapy, ART. It's relatively new. Amy Schumann is a clinical social worker from Massachusetts and the one running the show, a training session for clinicians.
So check your body head to toe. Find what emotions and physical sensations you have in your body right now.
I guess I'm a bit nervous.
Mm-hmm.
I feel it kind of a little bit here.
Okay.
I put my hand right below my chest.
What does it feel like?
It's like a bit of an energy, like when you drink too much coffee, I guess.
Oh, did you drink too much coffee?
Yeah, maybe that's it.
So we'll compete.
I'm actually lying to her. What I feel is afraid. I've never been in any kind of mental health anything. It's all weird and new.
Look at my hand and tell me if I'm too close to you. Do you want me to back up or is this okay?
That's okay.
Are you sure you didn't sound certain?
No, it's fine.
And move your eyes to follow my hand. Am I going too fast or too slow?
She holds her hand about a foot and a half from my face.
Notice that coffee feeling in your abdomen.
She's waving her hand now. I follow with my eyes back and forth really quick.
Take a deep breath.
The basic idea with this form of psychotherapy is to focus on the physical instead of what's going through your head. A handful of similar therapies have been cropping up in recent years. They look at what you're feeling as opposed to thinking and involve doing some kind of physical action. Eye movements here, but others use finger tapping, for instance.
One of the theories that we would base this on is the fact that we're tied somatically to whatever we're experiencing emotionally or cognitively, that they're all tied together.
Anxiety, for example, has a physical or somatic aspect, a pit in your stomach, a lump in your throat. Amy describes this approach as bottom-up. Work on the simpler body feelings before complicated thought patterns. There's very little actual talking, like you might expect in a typical therapist's office.
So would I wouldn't talk about what's troubling me, I would just imagine it?
Exactly. As a matter of fact, when I work with someone, they don't have to say a word about what they're working on. I could know nothing about the content.
Whatever it is, Amy says she can reprogram it. Going through this process, following her hands, she says she can change my response to whatever it is that's bothering me, and she can do it quickly in like 3 or 4 sessions.
It's amazing to have something that shows in the research an average of 3.6 sessions. That makes it hard for people to believe that it's really true.
Amy works for a nonprofit, crisscrossing the country, spreading this ART gospel, training counselors and therapists. She tells me ART is most associated with treating trauma, but it can work for lots of issues.
Things like depression, OCD. It can even help with pain.
Amy's students, the mental health clinicians, seem to be buying it. One calls it miraculous, hopes it'll finally help her heal patients where other treatments have failed. But okay, this is somebody waving their hand in front of my face. This is my eyes darting back and forth. Where did all this come from? It turns out ART was created about 10 years ago, and it's based off an older, similar therapy called EMDR. It stands for Eye Movement Desensitization and Reprocessing. Deanni Leliotis runs training for the EMDR Institute, and she tells me about the founding mother of that therapy, American psychologist Francine Shapiro.
Dr. Shapiro was a force of nature and a true, true visionary. She always had the vision that EMDR could help with world peace.
The story goes, EMDR was first kind of revealed to Francine in a park. She was a psych grad student. This was in the late 80s. Francine passed away last year, but she appears in this old TV interview talking about it.
While on a walk one day, she noticed that when she thought about something disturbing, her eyes moved in a certain way. And then the thought no longer upset her.
Then I started doing it deliberately to see if it would work, and the same thing happened. The thought shifted away, and when I brought it back, it wasn't as disturbing.
If I had seen you that day in the park, what would I have noticed about your eyes?
That they were moving very rapidly in a diagonal, just flickering up and down very, very rapidly. So I thought I stumbled upon some mind process that worked with thought.
Francine became Dr. Shapiro, spent years developing this method, pushing for studies and training.
She said, this is what's working. This is going to help people and give them symptom relief and help people heal. And she gave it away.
ART, the approach I tried in the hotel room, it also has a founding mother, a family therapist and former student of EMDR. It had a pretty similar visionary-driven trajectory. I had assumed therapies got more boring starts at universities or research labs, underwent a bunch of studies and proofs, and then got farmed out all at once to professionals in the field. The EMDR, ART origin stories seemed almost religious by comparison, kind of culty. But it turns out they're completely routine. Someone comes up with a new method and then...
There's a curve, there's a kind of a growth curve where you pick up adherence, right? You pick up practitioners, you pick up clients.
That's David Baker from the University of Akron. He studies the history of psychology. He says psychotherapies typically grow this grassroots way. Some visionary practitioner or group will go around proselytizing.
You don't have to go much further than to think about psychoanalysis and Sigmund Freud.
Freud used to do wide-ranging speaking tours, touting his brand new psychoanalysis. That kind of thing still happens today. New therapies need believers, people who go on clinical intuition, something like faith. And eventually, the hope is you reach what David calls a critical mass of followers.
And you reach, I guess, enough of a critical mass where those become more widely known and become subject then to empirical testing.
A treatment seems to work, so more people use it even before knowing precisely why it works. The horse comes before the cart because it kind of has to. Psychology is relatively young, and no one has all the answers when it comes to the mind. David says evidence is mounting for these new therapies, but the verdict is still out on whether they're the real deal. The fact that they're spreading anyway worries some in the industry, like Robin Cotton. She's a psychologist and a dean at Sacred Heart University in Connecticut.
So the fact that there's very scant evidence for the effectiveness of a particular treatment or a particular technique, that doesn't necessarily mean that it won't be widely used in clinical practice. We know for a fact that many unsubstantiated techniques are, in fact, widely used in clinical practice.
Robin says there's science-based treatments and evidence-based treatments. Those sound similar, but she explains there's a big difference.
Unfortunately, the American Psychological Association's criteria for what constitutes evidence-based, to my mind, the bar is really low.
Basically, if enough patients say a treatment helped them, it's considered evidence-based. But
not all data is created equal, right? So someone could say, this therapy really worked for me. And then someone says, well, how do you know? Well, I felt better afterwards.
That's not enough for Robin. It doesn't tell you why a treatment helped them, how it works. These new eye-moving, finger-tapping therapies, they illustrate what Robin and others call psychology's science practice gap.
The science practice gap is real and enduring, if I were to be realistic about it.
She says if you don't understand why and how a treatment works, you can't improve it. Or even be sure it's really working in the first place. Like with ART, is it the hand moving that's helping people, or is it just that you're in the room with a caring therapist? She thinks all this is getting worse.
So I think it's an uphill battle, quite frankly. I think narrowing the science practice gap is an uphill battle.
There is actually a researcher in Florida who's been conducting the kind of science I think Robin would like to see. University of South Florida epidemiologist Kevin Kipp. He's been studying accelerated resolution therapy for years. I ask him what Robin's asking. How does this approach work?
With respect to ART, we don't have the foggiest idea. Having said that,
he hopes a brain study he's just begun will have some answers. His best guess at the moment is that the therapy may exploit the general malleability of our memory. Each time you recall memories from wherever in your brain, they change.
Undergo protein synthesis, molecular change, whether you want that to occur or not.
In ART, eventually you start purposely editing your memories in your head, remembering what happened, but also imagining how you wish things would have went down. Deep breaths, eye movements, the whole time. Enough of this, and the bad memories just don't bother you as much.
There's still, I would say, tremendous skepticism. What's happening right now, and you went to a training, is the training is outpacing the research. Research is slow.
So why are so many professional clinicians so ready to start using this approach to leap over or into the science practice gap? Part of the attraction may be that very serious people are taking this stuff seriously. For example, one of the therapy's big boosters is an Army colonel.
My name's Colonel Wendy Waits. I'm a psychiatrist.
Wendy heads up behavioral health at the Walter Reed National Military Medical Center. The colonel had two problems treating veterans. First, treatments took too long and vets would drop out too soon. And second, with two wars raging, there were just too many of them. Accelerated resolution therapy promised to work fast, and crucially for vets, it could work without forcing patients to show any vulnerability, break down, retelling their trauma to some shrink.
I was thinking, if we can get patients in and out of the clinic in 3 to 4 sessions, you know, and moving on with their lives, that would be, you know, a big win.
And it was. Not just, by the way, for PTSD. Wendy treats the family members of service members as well.
So I've used it for addictions. I've used it for panic disorder or panic attacks. I've used it even in adolescent populations for things like perfectionism, bullying, family discord, body image issues.
After we spoke, the colonel's public affairs officer called me to drive home this point, that Wendy really believed ART could be part of the solution for so much more.
I mean, many of us who've been trained in ART have a hard time really, it's hard to do anything else when you know how effective ART can be.
Wendy is a soldier. I imagine goal and mission oriented. The how and why of ART is less important to her than to Robin, the Sacred Heart Dean. Wendy needs something that works now, and ART seems to, and that is enough. Back at the hotel conference room, I'm doing ART with Amy, the clinical social worker. I'm facing her with that anxious feeling I had said was too much coffee.
Notice that coffee feeling in your abdomen.
She waves her hand. I follow for about a minute.
Take a deep breath.
We do it again, and Amy asks me to imagine something getting rid of that feeling in my stomach.
You could have a salve that you rub on it to soothe it. You could have a waterfall wash it away. You can imagine anything that would be soothing for you while you're moving your eyes.
Her hands are waving again. I follow. I think of water. Time and maybe brain scans will tell if these therapies are the real thing or just widening psychology's science practice gap. But whatever it was in my stomach, sitting in that chair, by the time Amy finished waving her hand,
and take a breath,
it was gone.
That story was reported by Jad Slayman. We're talking about changing medical treatments, and coming up, as a health reporter, Kate Pickard wrote lots of articles about breast cancer treatment. But then she was diagnosed herself, and she realized that treatment was totally different from what she thought it would be, and a lot more complex.
Here's how it went. Wednesday, take steroid pills to ward off an allergic reaction to tomorrow's chemotherapy. Take anti-anxiety pills to ward off the jitteriness and insomnia caused by the steroid pills. Thursday, get chemo.
That's still to come
Friday,
on The Pulse.
Take steroid pills to prevent an after chemo allergic reaction. Take anti-anxiety pills to ward off the jitteriness and insomnia caused by the steroid pills.
Support for The Pulse comes from Select Greater Philadelphia. Greater Philadelphia's research institutions, collaborative spirit, capital, support for entrepreneurs, and quality of life are attracting leading life sciences firms. More at discoverystartshere.com.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about changing medical treatments and how providers and patients navigate those changes. In 2014, it seemed like a physician was going to revolutionize the way care is delivered to some of the country's sickest and poorest patients. Patients with chronic health problems, diabetes, mental health issues, addiction, who use a lot of expensive healthcare services, especially the ER. The man out to fix this issue was Jeffrey Brenner. He was working in Camden, New Jersey, trying to cut down on hospital readmissions for these patients. He won a MacArthur Genius Award. He was getting national attention.
Jeff Brenner may be healthcare's best hope.
That's Dan Gorenstein, host of the healthcare podcast Trade-Offs.
People were really excited. And I think they were excited is because there was a promise here that you could potentially take some of the most disenfranchised patients, people who are sick, people who are poor, people who have mental illness, addiction, all these things, and potentially you could get them healthier and simultaneously keep them out of the hospital, keep them out of the emergency room, and save a bunch of money. So this seemed like the total win-win.
Dan covered Brenner's work for years. Brenner started the Camden Coalition, a nonprofit that was providing patients with easy access to primary care, social workers, and nurses to navigate their healthcare needs, to keep them healthier and out of the hospital.
I was just going from place to place to place to place. I could go sleep on the bench or sleep on a rock. That was my daily routine.
Poverty and poor health combine to keep patients' lives constantly on the edge. A small hiccup in one part of life can wreak havoc on the rest.
For more, it was a missed rent payment.
He spent the next 2.5 years barely keeping it together. And when he couldn't, he wound up in the emergency room.
70 times.
Larry Moore landed in the ER 70 times over those 2.5 years. 6 times, he got admitted to the hospital.
That coalition hypothesis?
We would connect the dots for sick and complicated people and navigate them to all the different kind of care that they needed, and they would stop going to the hospital.
Everybody seemed ready to buy into this, but Brenner insisted that his approach should be evaluated.
We could have coasted, but I didn't want to do that. We wanted to rigorously test our work.
In his podcast, Dan covers what happened next. So how did Jeff Brenner and the Camden Coalition set out to really evaluate this work?
So Jeff reached out to an economist up at MIT, Amy Finkelstein, and he wanted to know if we have one group of patients who get this care, right? You've got the social worker, the nurse, the community health worker, and they're working with the patient for 3 months and they're helping navigate them around. Do those people end up in the hospital and the emergency room less than the people who are just as sick and struggling just as much, but get sort of the regular standard care, which is nothing? You know, when they are discharged from the hospital, they're just told, you know, go to the pharmacy and pick up some pills. So they took 5 years-ish to evaluate these two groups of people, and they wanted to see, would this work? And this was a randomized controlled trial, which is the gold standard of evidence, so the most rigorous way to evaluate a program. And they found that it didn't work, that the people who were getting all this extra special care were just as likely to end up back in the hospital as the people who weren't getting the special care, which was a huge disappointment around the country.
Yeah. So does that mean this whole idea failed?
It's a great question. I think there's a temptation to be like, well, yeah, it failed. It doesn't work. But this is an organization that is, as you said, dedicated to treating some of the sickest, most expensive patients in one of the poorest, roughest communities in our country. What they've also begun to do is add social services, get more serious about making sure there's legal assistance, making sure there's opioid use disorder treatment, right? Making sure that there's housing.
The organization is tweaking the approach. Before, primary care was the hub for all of the patient's needs.
And that what is really required is a more cohesive approach that combines healthcare services, but also more social services to meet housing needs, mental health needs, food, job needs, income needs, trying to offer lots of doors because lots of people have lots of needs.
So Dan says they are still changing how healthcare is delivered to people.
The Camden Coalition is seen as one of the national leaders. When I interviewed the economist who did the evaluation, she compared it to early days of studying cancer, right? You're beginning to look at a very complex problem. And when you're beginning, you don't know that much. Her impression of the coalition and other people's impression of the coalition is that these people really are at the vanguard of thinking about this marginalized community, these people who are super sick and who have lots of social problems, and how you work with them. Nobody's got a solution. And I think people understand, and I honestly think people respect the coalition for taking this unique stand of, we're going to actually test our stuff, even though it might not work. That takes guts.
Yeah. Thank you, Dan.
Thank you, Mikan.
That's Dan Gorenstein. He's the host of the healthcare podcast Trade-Offs. They've covered the work happening in Camden in their episode Hotspotters on Trial. You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mikan Scott. We're talking about changing medical treatments. Kate Pickard was diagnosed with breast cancer in 2014. She was only 35 at the time, a healthcare reporter for Time magazine and a new mom with a young daughter. It was a total shock. She had no family history at all.
My MRI showed that I had two invasive tumors in my left breast, as well as breast cancer that had spread to my lymph nodes.
She went from being a healthy adult with a demanding career to being a patient with an aggressive form of breast cancer in less than a month. But treatments for her specific cancer had changed and advanced a lot. If you had been diagnosed in 1994 instead of 2014, what might your experience been like?
I probably would have died. The type of breast cancer that I was diagnosed with is called HER2-positive breast cancer. It was one of the most fatal, and today it's one of the most survivable types of breast cancer, and that's because there is a drug that exists now that targets specifically HER2-positive breast cancer cells.
Kate wrote a book about her experience and breast cancer in general. It's called Radical: The Science, Culture, and History of Breast Cancer in America. I asked her to read from a chapter where she described her chemo regimen.
Here's how it went. Wednesday, take steroid pills to ward off an allergic reaction to tomorrow's chemotherapy. Take anti-anxiety pills to ward off the jitteriness and insomnia caused by the steroid pills. Thursday, get chemo. Friday, take steroid pills to prevent an after-chemo allergic reaction. Take anti-anxiety pills to ward off the jitteriness and insomnia caused by the steroid pills. Return to the clinic for a shot of a drug that will boost my immune system. Begin to feel sick. Take anti-nausea drugs. Smoke pot. Saturday, feel sicker. Take anti-nausea pills. Smoke pot. Sleep. Sunday, feel sick. Take anti-nausea pills. Smoke pot. Sleep. Monday, feel somewhat sick. Take anti-nausea pills. Tuesday, feel better. Wednesday, return to work. 2 weeks would pass, and I would start the cycle over again. Our friends, meanwhile, celebrated the forward progress of their lives. They got married, started new jobs in new cities, had babies, bought houses. The milestones were normal for people our age, but I resented them nonetheless. While my friends were living, I was trying not to die.
If you think about what you went through there, what were some aspects of it that surprised you, even though you probably thought you had a pretty good sense of what it's like to have chemo or what that kind of treatment looked like? So what came as a surprise to you?
So many things. Even though I was a healthcare reporter, I had never investigated the chemotherapy experience specifically. So my impression of what chemotherapy was like, I think, was shaped like it is for a lot of people through what I had seen in movies and on television and in magazine articles. And so I really expected that I would be vomiting every day, that I would be completely exhausted, and that I would be bald. And in fact, I worked throughout my chemotherapy. I would get sick for nauseous for a few days after each infusion, but the infusions were 3 weeks apart. So the majority of my time in chemotherapy, I felt reasonably okay and was able to work and take care of my daughter. The other thing that really surprised me was very early before I began chemotherapy, a doctor that I had met with mentioned that I possibly didn't have to lose my hair. And to me, this was a profound piece of information. I was the mother to a 3-year-old daughter, and I was very eager for any opportunity to sort of not appear to be very sick. And so I chose to do something called scalp cooling, which is basically that I wore these below freezing caps on my head while I was getting chemotherapy infusions. And what the caps did was chill my scalp so much so that the blood flow slowed in my scalp and my hair follicles kind of went to sleep.
How did it change your vision for yourself and what you wanted to do? You said in the part we heard, I was trying not to die, but you must have thought about what came after that. Like, when I survive this thing, what am I going to do next?
Yeah, I mean, in addition to thinking, okay, I want to write a book about this, but in a more long term sense, you know, I think, and a lot of cancer patients say this, or people who've had a life threatening experience. You know, my cancer experience definitely made me more appreciative of life itself. Every, you know, day and moment with my daughter, I really appreciate. I probably hug her too much because I feel so grateful to be here and to be with her. I just feel incredibly grateful to be alive and to be able to experience life.
Is it hard to hold on to that feeling of appreciation?
Yes. Yeah, it's a great question. I have found, and I write about this a little bit in the book, I only have to sort of mentally time travel back to the early days of my diagnosis before I understood what my treatment would be and when I was most scared. But I do think it's true that, you know, as you kind of go back to, you know, normal life, such as it is, you really want to just feel normal and not think about cancer every day, right? So thinking about cancer is a way of appreciating that you don't have cancer. But at the same time, you know, I don't want breast cancer to define my whole life and who I am. So it's kind of a tricky balance. Yeah.
Right. I'm trying to think like a daily annoyance, like being stuck in traffic. I'm kind of thinking, if you are recently feeling better, then that's not so bad because it's like, hey, I'm stuck in traffic, but at least I'm not in chemotherapy right now.
Right.
But then now you're almost 5 years out and you're stuck in traffic and you don't want to think, oh, I'm stuck in traffic, but I also don't have cancer. I mean, it's just...
Yeah, I mean, I really do try to remind myself, like, this is annoying, but it's not worth getting angry about. So, I mean, I'm not a perfect person. I definitely still get mad at my husband about silly things that aren't worth fighting about. So I don't think I'm a dramatically different person, but people in my life that are close to me have told me that I've mellowed out a lot post-cancer. And I think that's a good thing. So I'm grateful for that.
Kate Pickard is the author of Radical, The Science, Culture, and History of Breast Cancer in America. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts. Our health and science reporters are Alan Yu, Liz Tung, Jad Slayman, and Steph Yin. Our intern is Sabrina Ems. We had production assistance from Julian Harris. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Xavier Lopez is our associate producer. Lindsay Lazarski is our producer. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Behavioral Health Reporting on the Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to thinking, doing, and supporting innovative approaches in integrated healthcare. WHYY's Health and Science Reporting is supported by a generous grant from the Public Health Management Corporation's Public Health Fund. PHMC gladly supports WHYY and its commitment to the production of services that improve our quality of life.